Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
It's good to be back in Nashville. I always look forward to October when I come to the Literary Festival, but this is a kind of a treat to come a little earlier. So good to be here. I appreciate you coming out tonight. I do have a new book out. It's called The Cove, and it began about 5 years ago. I was doing some research, actually doing research for Serena, and I'd grown up in Western North Carolina, and I'd known that there had been what I thought was a German prisoner of war camp near Asheville, up Hot Springs, right above Asheville. And I was doing more research, and I found out that this was during World War I. It was actually a German internment camp. I mean, we normally think of Japanese internment camps, and we don't very often think of German internment camps, but there actually were these camps in the United States during World War I. And that I found that to be a very interesting story, in part because of the reaction of some of the people in the community to that camp in very interesting ways, both positive and negative. But I also, as I was doing that particular research, I found out that a number of the prisoners or internees had come from a ship called the Vaterland, which was a ship at that time, and we're talking about 1917, 1918, was the largest ship in the world. Largest ship had ever been built. It was a luxury liner, been built in Hamburg, Germany, and it made the Titanic pretty much look like a river barge. I've actually found a book that had about 50 photographs of the interior, and it's just amazing. Indoor swimming pool, Flemish paintings, just incredible. Gold faucets, amazing luxury liner. And the story of it was fascinating, because what happened was that the ship had gone from Hamburg to New York City, you know, then gone back, and this is 1914, and it had gone back into New York Harbor when war broke out in Europe. And for 3 years, the ship was marooned in New York Harbor. The United States was neutral, so the crew continued to get paid. And for 3 years, they were pretty much free to do what they pleased. Actually, several of them became American citizens. Several of them found their way back to Germany. The majority, though, just kind of came and went from the ship. They would swim in the Hudson River, skate in Central Park in the winter, attend concerts, opera, did fundraising for the Germans. even an event where William Randolph Hearst was involved. It was just an amazing story, so that when the United States entered the war, the ship was seized, actually became a troop ship for the United States called the Leviathan, renamed the Leviathan. And the United States had to decide what to do with all these Germans. And what they did was they sent a number of them, as I say, to Western North Carolina, including members of the orchestra. And these remnants of the orchestra would even give concerts in North Carolina on Sundays. Pretty amazing, you know. And after I read all this, I was kind of paralyzed, because there was a part of me that thought, you know, if you can't make an interesting novel out of this, you better give up. I mean, you know. And I really, it just kind of was almost like it was too good. You know, the history was better than anything I could make up. And I'd done all that research, and a few months passed, and every novel I've written has begun with a single image. That's just the way I work, maybe because I started off primarily as a poet. But I finally, one morning, an image came to me of a young mountain woman. She was washing clothes, and she heard something, and she actually pulled back some rhododendron leaves And she saw something. I'm gonna show you what, or read to you what she saw in just a moment. But once I had that image, I entered the novel. But I had to get to know her. And as I started writing the book, and I never outline, I never plot. I don't know where it's going. I just kind of followed her. It became clear to me that this novel was going to take place in a very, what we call probably here too, coves. Deep gaps between mountains. And I'd always wanted to write a novel where landscape became destiny, because I think very often it does. I'm fascinated with that idea. I'm fascinated with, you know, what I believe to be true, that the landscape a person is born into affects his or her view of reality. I tell my students very often that, you know, Gatsby is the quintessential Midwesterner. You know, he has that kind of expansive vision that he can believe almost anything, and just look out endless possibilities. But I think people are born in mountains. It can be either very nurturing, and I speak from my own family's history, you know, having been in the western North Carolina mountains for my family a couple hundred years, that you feel so protected by the mountains, and that you can never feel comfortable in another place. I was actually reading a book by the Harvard psychologist, Robert Coles, I think is his name, and he asked a woman who'd moved from the Appalachian Mountains to Detroit to explain, how would you describe Detroit? And she said, it's the place where the mountains are not. And, you know, I think that's what I'm getting at. But the other way that I found it affects, and I see this in my own family, is a very dark streak of fatalism. And I think part of that comes from just where traditional farms would have been built. They would have been built near water sources, so they would not have been on ridgetops the way people might build a house today. And just the lack of light that will come into those places. I mean, that's physiological, what it does to us. But I think also there's something to the fact that if you're constantly looking and seeing the mountains towering over you, that perhaps it makes you feel somewhat insignificant in comparison, that, you know, you never have that long view. Maybe that's just the writer in me that wants to believe that. But I think there's something to it. And I've talked to other people about this, and actually people in other mountain cultures around the world. And it's been interesting to talk about these kinds of things. But anyway, as I say, I wanted to write a novel where the cove in some ways was maybe the dominant character. And Laurel is born into this cove, or her family lives in this cove. And it's a place of superstition. The people in the community are very wary of it. They don't like to go there, particularly because bad luck seems to have fallen upon anyone who lives there, including Laurel's family, because her parents have died young. She's pretty much been raised. She and her brother had to raise themselves. And they've been ostracized by the community, particularly Laurel, because she's been born with a birthmark on her shoulder. And the people in the area believe that she's actually been, it's as if the cove itself, its darkness, has clasped her and claimed it for its own. So she's in, she's been ostracized. Her brother now is back from the war when the novel begins. He's lost an arm, but he's come back. And he's accepted into the community. He's finally starting to get at least more accepted than Laurel will ever be. And at the beginning of the novel, he's actually, though Laurel doesn't know it, about to leave her there for the rest of her life alone, which has been her great fear, that she would always be there, left in that place by herself. But then, something has to happen or I wouldn't have a novel, right? One other thing I might mention to you, I think, though it's probably made clear in the context, one of the most beautiful birds I think that's ever graced America was the Carolina parakeet. If you've seen the pictures of them, Audubon did several paintings of them. Beautiful birds, and we very often don't think of parakeets being in the Appalachian Mountains, but they were. And these birds were about 14 inches. They were big parakeets. and just beautiful, beautiful birds. But unfortunately, they're extinct now. The last one died in a zoo in the 1930s. And the main reason they're extinct was because if the birds settled, a flock of the birds settled in an orchard, if one was wounded by a farmer, shot or otherwise injured, even if the flock was 300, the other 299 would not leave the bird that was wounded. And they would keep circling back until not one was left alive. And it's a really sad story. And I've read some 19th century reports, but journals where people talked about this, tough people that would not necessarily be very sentimental toward animals. And even they were deeply moved by this. Chapter 1, so I'm going to read the opening, and I think you'll recognize who this might be that Laurel sees. First, Laurel thought it was a warbler or thrush, though unlike any she'd heard before. Its song more sustained, as if so pure no breath need carry it into the world. Laurel raised her hands from the creek and stood. She remembered the bird Miss Calicut had shown to class. A Carolina parakeet, Miss Calicut had said, and unfolded a handkerchief to reveal the green body and red and yellow head. Most parakeets live in tropical places like Brazil, Miss Calicut explained, but not this one. She'd let the students pass the bird around the room, telling them to look closely and not forget what it looked like, because soon there'd be none left, not just in these mountains, but probably in the whole world. 16 years since then, but Laurel remembered the long tail and thick beak, how the green and red and yellow were so bright they seemed to glow. Most of all, she remembered how light the bird felt inside the handkerchief's cool silk, as if even in death retaining the weightlessness of flight. Laurel couldn't remember if Miss Calicut described the parakeet's song, but what she heard now seemed a fitting match, pretty as the parakeets themselves. As Laurel rinsed the last soap from her wash, the song merged with the water's rhythms and the soothing smell of rose pink and bee balm. She lifted Hank's army shirt from the pool and went to where the granite outcrop leaned out like a huge anvil. Emerging from the mountain's vast shadows was, as always, like stepping from behind a curtain. She winced from the sunlight, and her bare feet felt the strangeness of treading a surface, not a slant. The granite was warm and dry, except on the far side where the water flowed. But even there, the creek slowed and thinned, as if it too savored the light and was reluctant to enter the cove's darkness. Laurel laid Hank's shirt near the ledge and stretched out the longer right sleeve first, then the other. She looked around the bedraped granite, her wash like leavings from the stream's recent flooding. Laurel raised her chin and closed her eyes, not to hear the bird, but to let the sun immerse her face in a warm, waterless bath. The only place in the cove she could do this, because the outcrop wasn't dimmed by ridges and trees. Instead, the granite caught and held the sunlight. Laurel could be warm here, even with her feet numb by the creek water. Hank had built a clothesline in the side yard, but she didn't use it, even in winter. Clothes dried quicker in the sunlight, and they smelled and felt cleaner, unlike the cove's depths where clothes hung a whole day, retained a mildewed dampness. "They'll dry just as quick if I ain't watching," Laurel told herself, set the wicker basket down. She remembered how Becky Dobbins, a store owner's daughter, asked why the farmer killed such a pretty bird. "Because they'll eat you apples and cherries," Riley Watkins had answered from the back row. "Anyway, they're the stupidest things you ever seen," Riley added, told how his daddy fired into a flock and the unharmed parakeets didn't fly away but kept circling until not one was left alive. Miss Calicut had shaken her head. "It's not because they're stupid, Riley." Laurel followed the creek's ascent, stepping around waterfalls and rocks and felled trees when she had to, otherwise keeping her feet in water and away from any prowling copperhead or rattlesnake. The land steepened and the water blurred white. Oaks and tulip poplars dimmed the sun and rhododendron squeezed the banks tighter. Laurel paused and listened, the bird's call rising over the water's rush. They never desert the flock, Miss Calicut had told them, and Laurel had never known it to be otherwise. On the rare and rare occasions the parakeets passed over the cove, they always flew close together. Sometimes they called to one another, a sharp cry of wee, wee, wee. A cry, but not a song, because birds didn't sing while flying. One time a flock lit in her family's orchard, the parakeets had no chance to sing. But this parakeet, if that's what it was, did sing, and it sang alone. Laurel sidled around another waterfall. The song became louder, clearer, coming not from the creek, but near the ridge crest. As quietly as possible, Laurel left the water and made her way through trees twined with virgin's bower, then into a thicket of rhododendron. Close now, the song source only a few yards away. On the thicket's other side, sunlight fell through a breach in the canopy. Laurel crouched and moved near, pulled aside a last thick-leaved rhododendron branch. A flash of silvery flame caused her to scuttle back into the thicket, brightness pulsing on the back of her eyelids. The song did not pause. She blinked until the brightness went away and again moved closer, no longer crouching but on her knees. Through a gap in the leaves, she saw a haversack, then shoes, pants. Laurel lifted her gaze, her eyelids squinched to shutter the brightness. A man sat with his back against a tree, eyes closed as his fingers skipped across a silver flute. All the while his cheeks pursed and puffed, nostrils flaring for air. The man's blonde hair was a greasy tangle, his whiskers not yet a full beard, but enough of one too, like his hair, snared dirt and twigs. Laurel let her gaze take in a blue chambray shirt, torn and frayed and missing buttons. The corduroy pants, ragged as the shirt, and shoes whose true color was lost in a lathering of dried mud. Sunday shoes, not brogans or topovers. Except for the flute, whatever else the man possessed looked to be in the haversack. A circle of black ground and charred wood argued he'd been on the ridge at least a day. The song ended and the man opened his eyes. He set the flute across his raised knees and tilted his head, as though awaiting a response to the song. Perhaps one he would not welcome, because he appeared suddenly tense. His eyes swept past Laurel, and she saw that no crow's feet crinkled the eyes, the brow and cheeks briar-scratched but unlined. The eyes were the same blue as water in a deep river pool, the face long and thin, features more hewn than needed. Laurel tugged the muslin on her left shoulder closer to her neck. Then the man closed his eyes again and pressed his lower lip to the metal, played something more clearly a human song. Up this high, the rhododendron blossoms hadn't fully wilted. Their rich perfume and the vanilla smell of the virgin's bower made Laurel lightheaded as minutes passed and one song blended into another. The sun leaned west, and what light the gap in the trees allowed sifted away. The flute's sparkling silver muted to gray, but the music retained its airy brightness. It felt like she'd listened only a few minutes, but when Laurel got back to the outcrop, Hank's shirt was almost dry. She gathered the socks and step-ins, her other muslin work dress, Hank's overalls. A purple butterfly lit on the stream edge to sip water. A pretty hue, most anyone would say, the same way they'd speak of church glass or bull thistle as pretty. Just not pretty on white skin, though Laurel hadn't known the difference until first grade. When she was 8, the taunts had gotten so bad that she'd scrubbed the birthmark with lye soap until the skin blistered and bled. Up on the ridge, the music stopped. Well, I think you all probably have a better idea than she does right now who that might be. It's not Orpheus, though in some ways I had that in mind when I opened the book that way. But Laurel will go back the next day and hear him again, still stays hidden. She goes back the third day, but she doesn't hear the song. She doesn't hear the music, so she is afraid that he's left, or that worse, because of her loneliness, she's imagined him. But she goes up to the to his campsite and finds him lying on the ground. He's been badly stung by yellow jackets, and Laurel helps him, takes him back to the cabin, and ministers to him, actually draws some of the poison with the poultices that she makes. And this was where I had an interesting technical problem, because I mentioned to you that I'd read a book about the internment camp in Western North Carolina, and it was called The German Invasion of Western North Carolina. It was written by a local woman who was not evidently a big fan of the Germans. But it's an incredible book. The woman's done a wonderful job, and actually I thank her in the book because the book was obviously very valuable. But there's a moment in the book about 120 pages in where she's finishing a paragraph, and she simply says, "And one of the Germans escaped." And that's it. I mean, you know, where did he go or what happened to him? She evidently wasn't interested, you know. That. And if I were a historian, that would, of course, be, you know, it's the kind of thing I would just be pulling my hair out. But as a novelist, all I could think was, well, thank you. You know, I'll take care of him. You know, you got him here. I'll take care of him the rest of the way. You know, I'll figure out where he goes. And but it did bring up another problem. I mean, and this is something I wondered about, you know, if you're a German in Western North Carolina in 1918, and even if you speak English, you know, your accent is going to not quite fit in, you know. Actually, I'm going to digress here a moment. There was actually a prisoner that escaped like this. I think he was actually a German prisoner of war, escaped during World War I, and went up to a woman, an old woman's house, old mountain woman's house, and started speaking in German at his door. And she shot and killed him because she thought he was a Yankee. You know, she'd heard about these Yankees, you know, and, you know, what happened, you know, for me, so I thought, you know, okay, you know, I've got to kind of put myself in this situation since my historian didn't help me any on this. So Laurel is actually, you know, helps him get his, and Hank, actually they take his clothes off and because of the stings and bathe him. Hank helps, and Laurel gets his clothes, and they're so filthy, she goes to wash them, and as she's getting ready to wash them, she finds a note, and the note says, "My name is Walter Smith, and because of a childhood affliction, I am unable to speak. I am trying to get to New York," and so that's the way I got around that. So she thinks he's mute, and he stays on for a few months, and he and Laurel start to fall in love. He stays, he's quite comfortable there, he feels safe because so few people will come into the cove believing it is haunted or a place of bad luck, misfortune. And they become lovers. And finally, the harvest comes in. They've actually had a good harvest, so the luck seems to be turning. And one night in the winter, Laurel feels something she's never felt before. It's a sensation, but she can't put a name to it. Hank fetched the razor and took the whetstone from the mantel. He placed the stone in his right elbow, the razor's blade rasping as Hank's good arm sawed like a fiddler's. "Would you be of a mind to play some music, Walter?" Laurel asked. "It's been near a week and I miss it." Walter nodded, and soon the flute's music filled the room, the rasping of steel on stone heard in the silences. The applewood burned now, adding licks of blue and green to the yellow flames. Laurel's needle caught the fire's light and different colors slid on and off the metal as it dipped and rose, all the while the fire's heat keeping the cold at bay. The balm of Gilead. That was the pattern she'd laid off with the bluing, using her mother's bedspread as her mother had used her mother's. It would be Hank and Carolyn's wedding gift. Laurel paused and pulled another piece of thread over the beeswax, then dipped the needle into the muslin to start another knot. An ashy bottom log buckled, sent up orange sparks, and resettled. Only then did Laurel realize that Walter had quit playing. It was like the flames and the music had so blended that one was lost in the other. She reached for Walter's hand and squeezed it. He laid his other hand on their clasped hands, and Laurel saw the scraped knuckles and broken nails, now a farmer's hand. Hank would bring in more kindling before he went to bed, but Laurel rose to do it. She stepped onto the porch and filled her arms. The night embraced her, and for once she wanted to be in dark and in cold, because it would be all the better when she went back inside and the fire's warmth and brightness again enveloped her. A few snowflakes came down in a slow, windless fall, white and soft as dogwood petals. A tear rolled down her cheek, then another and another. And though Laurel tried to blink them back, she couldn't blink fast enough, so set the kindling down and wiped her eyes. The lift of her heart she'd felt on the outcrop earlier with Walter, she now felt again. And it wasn't just love. She'd felt love before, known its depths when her mother died. This was something rarer. Happiness, Laurel thought. That must be what this is. She picked up the kindling, went inside. She and Walter and Hank stayed on the hearth at the hearth past midnight. And no one spoke, and no one seemed to want to, as if a single utterance might break some benevolent spell that had been cast over the cabin. So that's the cove. And I feel like since I'm in Nashville, I've got to read something about music. And this Alice, right, very graciously allowed me to borrow her book. So this is dedicated to you. I hope, and I also wanted to write it because my brother, who lives near me and is actually my first reader on all my work, I don't read or try not to read reviews. I mean, people send them to me, and I don't like to read them, but he reads them all, and he loves to pick out little snippets, particularly the ones that say something like, Rash's work is implacably grim, you know, that kind of thing. He loves that, you know. In Rash's work, it starts out dark and only gets darker. You know, he loves to send me little things like that. But I do not think of myself as being such a dark writer. And actually, I don't. I'm not a nihilist, certainly. And I think my people and most of my characters do the best they can in the circumstances life gives them. But I would like to think I have a little bit of a sense of humor. So if you don't laugh, I guess I will find out about that right now. But I think, like a lot of writers, I wish I'd been a musician. You know, that's what I wanted to be, I wasn't. But I wanted to write a story where at least I could pretend to be one, and actually one that would probably, if I'd been one, this is probably what would have ended up doing. I just thought, you know, I'd be the kind of guy that they'd have to play, Freebird every night, And so I started thinking, actually I had a friend who was in a band and he had to play that every night. And I thought, you know, what if you had to be at a honky tonk and you had to play it every hour? You know, how would that be? And it's called Waiting for the End of the World, and it's for Alice. So it's somewhere between Saturday night and Sunday morning clockwise, and I'm in a cinder block roadhouse called The Last Chance, and I'm playing Freebird for the fifth time tonight, but I'm not thinking of Ronnie Van Zant, but an artist dredged up from my former life, Willie Yates. And his line, surely some revelation is at hand. But the only rough beast slouching toward me is my rhythm guitar player, Sammy Griffin, who's down on all fours weaving through the crowd of tables between the bathroom and stage. One of the great sins of the 60s was introducing drugs to the good old boy element of Southern society. If you were some Harvard psychology professor like Timothy Leary, drugs might well expand your consciousness, but they work just the opposite way for people like Sammy, shriveling the brain to a reptilian level of aggression and paranoia. There's no telling what Sammy has snorted or swallowed in the bathroom, but his pupils have expanded to the size of dimes. He passes a table and sees a bare leg, a female leg, and grabs hold. He takes off an attached high heel and starts licking the foot. It takes about 3 seconds for a bigger foot with a steel-capped toe to swing into the back of Sammy's head like a football player kicking an extra point. Sammy curls up in a fetal position and blacks out among the peanut shells and cigarette butts. So now it's just my bass player, Bobo Lingerfeld, Hal Deaton, my drummer, and me. I finished Freebird, so that means the next songs are my choice. They got to have Freebird at least once an hour, Rodney said when he hired me, saying it like his clientele were diabetics needing insulin. The rest of the time, you play what you want, he'd add. And this is my favorite musician to ever come out of Nashville or be involved in Nashville. I turned to Bobo and Hal and play the opening chords of Gary Stewart's Roaring, and they fall in. Stewart was one of country music's neglected geniuses, once dubbed Honky Tonk's white trash ambassador from hell by one of the few critics who bothered listening to him. His music's 2 centuries worth of pent-up Appalachian soul. Beyond the tables of human wreckage, I see Hubert McLean sitting in the bar, beer in one hand and Louisville Slugger in the other. Hubert's our bouncer, 250 pounds of atavistic Celtic violence, coiled and ready to happen. On the front of the ball cap covering his survivalist buzz cut, a leering skeleton waves a sickle in one hand and a black and white checkered victory flag in the other. The symbolism is unclear, except that anyone wearing such a cap, especially while gripping a 36-ounce ball bat, is not someone you want to displease. On the opposite side of the bar, Rodney is taking whatever people hand him. Crumpled bills, handfuls of nickels and dimes, payroll checks, wedding rings, wristwatches. One time a guy offered a gold filling he'd dug out of his mouth with a pocket knife. Rodney didn't even blink. Watching him operate, it's easy to believe Rodney's simply an updated version of Flim Snopes, the kind of guy whose first successful business venture is showing photos of his naked sister to his junior high peers. But that's not the case at all. Rodney graduated from Vanderbilt with a degree in social work. He wanted to make the world better, but according to Rodney, the world wasn't interested. His career as a social worker ended the same week it began. Rodney had borrowed a church bus to take some of Columbia's disadvantaged youth to a Braves game. Halfway to Atlanta, the teenagers mutinied. They beat Rodney with a tire iron, took his money and clothes, and left him naked and bleeding in a ditch. A week later, the same day Rodney got out of the hospital, the bus was found half submerged in the Okefenokee Swamp. It took another month to round up the youth, several of whom had procured entry-level positions in a Miami drug cartel. Rodney says running the last chance is a philosophical statement. Above the cash register, he's plastered one of those Darwinian bumper stickers with the fish outline and 4 evolving legs. Rodney's drawn a speech bubble in front of the fish's mouth. Exterminate the brutes, the fish says. Advice Rodney seems to have taken to heart. There's only one mixed drink in the last chance, what Rodney calls the Terminator. It's 6 ounces of Jack Daniels and 6 ounces of Surrey County moonshine and 6 ounces of Sam's Choice tomato juice. Some customers claim a dash of lighter fluid is added for good measure. No one, not even Hubert, has ever drunk more than 3 of these and remained standing. It usually takes only 2 to put the drinkers onto the floor, tomato juice dribbling down their chins like they've just been shot in the mouth. Anyway. And it gets worse. Y'all know Gary Stewart? Y'all know who he is? Oh, gosh. Have you ever heard of She's acting single, I'm drinking doubles. No? Single again? Oh, man, you got to listen to Gary Stewart. He's great. He's great. Yeah. You got to listen to Gary. Great songwriter. I see the want to in your eyes. That doesn't ring a bell. Conway stole that one from me. All right. Well, I'm going to leave a little bit of time for some questions, if you have them. I hope you do. I want to finish with a poem just set on the other side of the line, Western North Carolina, not too far from here. When I was growing up in Western North Carolina, my uncle was a farmer and had a farm near Boone, had cattle as well as, doing the, his crops. And one thing that was always impressed by was there was a vet in that area who was actually in his mid-80s, and he was still going out on calls. I've always admired all vets, but large animal vets are special, even among veterinarians. I've actually got a couple who are friends, right, who are practicing now, but this guy would go out, and he would come, sometimes he'd get a call at 2 or 3 o'clock, which if you're that kind of vet, is a bad situation if a farmer waits that late or something's pretty bad wrong. Sometimes the animal would even be dead by the time he got there. And he'd sometimes know he probably wasn't going to get paid. But this vet would always go. He would always go. He was one of those who took it as a true calling. And a few years ago, I was remembering him, and I thought, what would it be like for him, for a man like that or a woman, to go out at night and, everybody else asleep? What would you think about? And so this is a poem called 3 A.M. and the Stars Were Out. And so I'll finish the reading part with this. When the phone rings way too late for good news, just another farmer wanting me to lose half a night's sleep, drive some backcountry washout for miles, fix what he's botched. On such nights, I'm like an old, drowsy god, tired of answering prayers. So let it ring a while. Hope they might hang up. Though, of course, they don't. Don't because they know the younger vets shuck off these dark expeditions to me, thinking it's my job, not theirs. Because I've done it so long, I'm used to such nights. Because old as I am, I'll still do what they refuse to. Soon I'm driving out of Marshall, headed north, most often toward Shelton Laurel, toward some barn where a calf that's been bad bred to save stud fees is trying to be born, or a cow laid out in a barn stall, dying of milk fever, easily cured if a man hadn't wagered against his own dismal luck, waited too late, hoping to save my fee for a salt lick, roll of barbed wire. It's not all his fault. Poor too long turns the smartest man stupid. Makes him see nothing beyond a short-term gain. Which is why I know more likely than not, I'll be arriving too late. What's to be done, best done with rifle or shotgun. So make driving the good part. Turn off my radio. Let the dark close around until I know a kind of loneliness. It doesn't feel sad as I pass the homes of folks I don't know, may never know, but wonder what they are dreaming, what life they wake to, thinking such things. Sometimes just watching for what stays unseen except on country roads after midnight, the copperheads soaking up what heat the blacktop still holds, foxes and bobcats. One time in the 50s, a panther, yellow eyes bright as truck beams, black-tipped tail swishing before leaping away through the trees, back into its extinction. All this thinking and watching, keeping my mind off what waits on up the road. Worst of all, the calves I have to pull one piece at a time, birthing death. Though sometimes it all works out. I turn a calf's head, then like a safe combination, the womb unlocks, calf slides free. Or this night when stubborn life got back on its feet, round eyes clear and hungry, my IV stuck in its neck. I take my time packing up. I ask for a second cup of coffee so I can linger a while in the barn mouth watching stars awake in their wide pasture. I'll be glad to take a couple of questions if you have them.
You had talked about was images that you see before each of your novels, and I was wondering in the novel Serena, what image got you going on that, and just how you came up with a character like Serena in the first instance.
Yeah, the image that got Serena going was actually an image of a woman on horseback, and she was on a ridge crest. It was in silhouette, and I could tell by her carriage that she was rather haughty, confident. And the sun was coming up behind her, and Serena has blonde hair, and it was the sun was almost, it was hitting, and it's almost like a crown. But there was also fog at the bottom of the crest. It was almost as if she was between heaven and earth. And I knew someone was watching her, and that person was watching her with both love and fear. And that, of course, would be Pemberton. And that image actually shows up about, 200 pages, about halfway through the book. But that's the one that triggered it. And, that's always a very mysterious process for me. But I make myself, what I've learned is that if the image, I cannot get rid of it. It just stays with me. I believe that I make myself believe, in a way, a little bit, not in comparison to artistic talent in any stretch of the imagination, but Michelangelo believed that the finished statue was already in the block of marble. I make myself believe that the novel's out there. This image, has a corresponding book, and whether that's true or not, it gets me through some tough times. Yeah, but yeah, that's how it started.
How did you decide to become a writer?
That's always an interesting question. How do you decide? I think sometimes it decides for you. I think for me it came down to the fact that it just seemed like I couldn't give up on it. I started a little later than most of my friends. I didn't really start writing fiction until I was about 20. But I wasn't writing anything any good for years, and I knew it. I'd read enough to where I knew I wasn't writing well, but there was something in me that just wouldn't give up. Stubbornness, maybe some kind of belief in myself, I'm not sure. But, it just kind of came, just persevering and knowing it was something I wanted to do. And I've always been a kind of person who's only wanted, I'm not a well-rounded person. I've only wanted to do one thing well in my life. At first, when I was in high school and college, it was actually an athlete. I ran track 800 meters in high school and college. But then I decided I wanted to be a writer. And and I just had to try. But I think even though I started later, I think writers, at least the writers I know, pretty much all have similar backgrounds as far as childhoods. They tended to be introverted, dreamy, and very comfortable being alone. And I always was. I loved to just be by myself. I could, I loved to stay with my grandmother in the summers, and I would leave the farm in the morning and she'd fix me a sandwich and I'd be gone all day. You couldn't imagine doing that with a child today. I'm talking about when I was 11, 12 years old, and her farm bordered the Blue Ridge Parkway, so I would just wander down the parkway and daydream, and sometimes I'd take a fishing rod with me, sometimes I wouldn't. But I was always very comfortable that way, and so I think very often it's, you don't have a choice. I think I had to live my life trying, and I would rather have failed at it than not know if I could do it.
My question is, you're a post-millennial.
Mm-hmm.
Around there, you know, like Charlie Rose and other people like mm-hmm. that. And you talked about your landscape mm-hmm. shaping the person.
Yeah.
Have you been to Texas?
Yes.
So my question is, what would you think the difference in personalities would be from someone who is like an Appalachian mm-hmm. and someone who was raised in the big blue skies of Texas?
I think, for me, when you read Cormac McCarthy, that openness in Blood Meridian, you know, that kind of, I mean, I know that's not Texas, but, you know, but just that open landscape, the kind of harshness of it, of the sun and everything, I think in a way, I mean, note the title, I think that landscape, at least from McCarthy's vision, is one of a bleakness of a place that almost where nature does not want us there in some ways. That would be my take on it, and Larry McMurtry, you know, reading some of his work and those small towns and that kind of, you know, the wind constantly blowing the dust. I would think that would have to have some kind of effect. I'm not as positive what it would be because I haven't lived in it, but I would. Yeah. But I know, you know, the other parts of Texas I know are more, you know, particularly as you get south, you know, toward Louisiana, it's a different landscape. I mean, what would you say? I mean, I'd be interested in what you would feel. I mean, do you feel like McCarthy and McMurtry capture that or not?
There's the individual. I don't think there's such desolation. There's poetry there.
Oh, yeah. Sounds like you've got a good landscape to write about. Yes. I've got 4 books of poetry. You know, the thing about being a poet is it's like belonging to a cult. You know, only a few people realize it. Somebody asked me, actually I was in Atlanta last night, somebody asked me, what's the difference between, you know, writing poetry and writing novels? And I said, well, you know, when I was writing poetry, I sold my books out of the back of my car. You know, I don't have to do that when I write novels. But I love them both. And I love short stories. I love all 3 forms. I would hope that, you know, all the time I've spent as, you know, writing poetry, the reader senses in my fiction that, you know, I'm trying to bring some of the poetry into it. You know, not necessarily trying to overdo it with description, but concision, and I hope some vividness. Yes.
One of my favorite books of yours is 1 Foot in Eden. Was that your first
novel? It was my first novel. The first one that, you know, I let see the light of day.
Yeah, that's a favorite of mine. But I noticed that a recurring theme in your novels is some of the larger scope of what's happened in the South and Western mm-hmm. North Carolina, the flood and the TVA. And was that is that personal to you at all? I mean, your family goes way back. Did it affect your family?
I think part of what writers do is you preserve something that you don't want lost. And in 1 Foot in Eden, more than any other novel, I wanted to preserve Appalachian speech. That doesn't necessarily mean that I was, you know, trying to be, you know, historically accurate all the time, but the rhythms of it, and to me what makes Appalachian speech so interesting, and not just Appalachian, most folk speeches, is how sophisticated it is, and yet, you know, people who you would think would be more intelligent don't get that. You know, they think, you know, when they hear somebody say, oh, you know, Appalachian, you know, they expect deliverance, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that just gets a little old after a while, particularly if you've, you know, like I say, you know, my family comes from that region. And what I found about Appalachian speech was that it's very inventive. You have this really sophisticated situation where you'll take a noun and make it into a verb. That's very often done. The rhythm of it is also very interesting. But the way you know a language, the intelligence of a language, is through simile, you know, metaphorical. And what Appalachian speech does beautifully, and this is where you see a delight just in the saying of something, is in the simile. The one that I always tell people about because it was one that's most memorable to me. I actually waited 3 novels to finally get it in a novel. My uncle, the same uncle I was mentioning earlier, I went into town with him in the Boone one day when I was about 18, and we were walking down the street, and it was summer, and there was an Appalachian co-ed, there's a university there, who was walking down the street toward us. And she was rather scantily clad by my uncle's standards. And he kind of looked, turned to me, and he said, "That girl hasn't got enough clothes on to wad a shotgun." And that is pretty brilliant if you think about it. I mean, because of the simile. I mean, taking 2 very unlike things out of his world and suddenly connecting them. And I've seen, you know, that kind of sophistication and delight, just delight in the language, I find very interesting.
When I was growing up in the hills of North Carolina, I asked this question dozens of times, and I never got an answer that satisfied me, so I'm going to ask you.
Okay.
What's the difference between a cove and a holler?
I don't think there's much difference at all. One thing I would say is I think a cove very often is thought of as being deeper from my experience and darker. That would be my experience, but some of you may... Yeah, the difference between a cove and a holler. I would, at least from my understanding, the place I knew as a cove near Boone was really deep. I mean, it was, you know, some people, I would hear my older relatives use the word holler sometimes, but they used cove with that, and I think there was a sense of the cove, kind of what you're saying, narrower, yeah, and deeper. But that's just from my family's experience. But I went into one. There was one, as I say, that I went into, and it was a dark place, and it was called Dismal. That was the name of it. Yeah, and it earned that name. It was a place that was very scary. An old mountain woman had wandered off down there and gotten lost. And my grandfather led a search party that went down to find her, and they found her, you know, 2 days later. And so it was always seen as a kind of scary place, and particularly for a kid, you know, because I'd go down there with my uncle sometimes hunting or fishing. And yeah, that's the best I can do for you. I gave you an answer at least.
Yeah. I think we have time for one more question.
Okay.
I wondered if you have many experiences with any of the people that were descendant or the firstborn of the people that were the last people to live in the national, what we call the Great Smoky National Park.
Oh, yeah.
One day after another.
Yeah.
There's a lot of crime and there's a lot of darkness.
I didn't
know whether people in North Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they were affected by it. And I mean, one of the tragedies of the Smokies, and actually in Serena, I did bring this up, you know, that, you know, people were forced to leave. And One Foot in Eden, you know, which actually happened in the 1970s. There's the most beautiful valley in South Carolina, upstate South Carolina, Jocassee Valley, was flooded. And that's the setting for One Foot in Eden, my first novel. And I interviewed a number of people who had to leave there. And it was just devastating for them. I mean, you know, their families had lived there generations. My family lost land to the Parkway. We didn't have any choice. That changed that area a lot where my family's from around Boone. And so I've witnessed that. And, you know, that's always, the question. I find it bizarre that very often people will use the word progress, and they always see that as positive. But there's very often a human cost. And I think part of what writers do very often is remind us of the human cost of those things. And I hope not just in a propagandist way, but just, you know, just as being true to those situations.
Well, thank y'all.